This happened about 6 years ago, in the early hours of my 20th birthday. At the time, I had been working as a carpet cleaner. It's also important to know that I am a 6-foot male, and at the time I weighed about 210 pounds. By nature, I'm an extremely cautious individual. Also in the particular area I worked in, there was a lot of gang activity. It was about 6 p.m. when I got a call from one of the head carpet cleaning techs. He explained that he couldn't do the late job that he was scheduled for, which was at 11 p.m. because his pregnant wife might have been going into labor and he had to go to the hospital. Seeing as I was broke, I told him that I would cover for him. We made it back to our shop at around 2:15 a.m. I got the truck ready for the other guys who would be taking it out in a few hours, and I headed home around 2:45 a.m. I had worked nearly 20 hours straight at this point, and I had a 45-minute drive home. I lived out in the middle of nowhere. Being exhausted and barely able to keep my eyes open, I decided to stop at a gas station and grab an energy drink. When I pulled in, I noticed a black Buick sitting in the far corner of the gas station parking lot. I didn't think much of it. Perhaps it was just the attendant's car. I went in, got my drink, and left. I had a gut feeling that something was wrong, and I began to check behind me to see if anyone was tailing me. I saw a pair of headlights in the distance, gaining on me fast. Deciding that I needed to confirm my suspicion before taking any drastic measures, I continued to drive while keeping my eye on the headlights in my rearview mirror. I was about 2 miles from home and still being tailed by the headlights. That's when I decided to take a detour. After about 10 minutes of maneuvering on back roads, I knew that things were getting serious as the headlights followed me every which way. My little four-cylinder Saturn was too slow to get away. Now fearing for my life, I knew I had to try and take control of the situation, as well as not leading my pursuers to my home, where my sister and her 2-month-old son were staying at the time. At the next stop sign, I put my car in park, placed my 12-inch military-grade knife up my left jacket sleeve, and grabbed the pistol I keep in my car for protection. I prayed that I would not have to use them. I then stepped out of my car. As I did, the car that had been following me came to a screeching halt, and 4 men exited the vehicle. It was then that I recognized that it was the same black Buick from the gas station. As the men climbed out, the moonlight revealed that one of them had been carrying a large chain, and the others were armed with a baseball bat, a tire iron, and the one who I assume was their leader had an axe. Seeing this, and making sure to keep my pistol out of any light that might have glinted off the side, I asked, "Is there a problem?" One of the men responded, "You're about to die, boy." It was at that moment that I realized this was some kind of gang initiation. I dropped the knife from my sleeve, gripping it in my left hand, while backing behind my open car door, trying to at least limit the directions they could attack me from. Seeing the knife and my attempt to put something between me and them, they laughed, and one of them said to another, "This motherfucker thinks he can beat us with a little knife." As they approached my car, I pulled the gun out and fired a warning shot at the leader's feet. The hardcore badasses quickly turned into scared little rabbits and were now hightailing it back to their car. I yelled after them, "You idiots picked the wrong guy to mess with. Now get the hell out of here before I put a bullet in your ass." They all fumbled back into the car and hauled ass. As they sped away, I was able to get a plate number and called the police. After getting off the phone with the operator, I got back into my car. I made it home at around 4 a.m. and passed out. When I woke up a few hours later, I called the police station to see if they had any leads. It turns out that the car was stolen, and they were unable to locate it. As far as I know, the car has never been found, and the 4 hoodlums were never caught. I'm telling this story on behalf of my departed grandmother. Truth oftentimes is stranger than fiction, and this story has been passed down through our family for years, It served as a reminder that you can never be too careful. I don't know the exact year, but this took place during the 1950s, when my grandmother was in her 20s and living in a very rural area of Kansas. At the time, she had already given birth to my mother. However, she claimed to be stepping out on my grandfather with another woman. I have no idea if that's actually true, but I don't see why she would lie. On one stormy night, my grandmother left her daughter with her mother and drove out to her girlfriend's house. According to her, the two of them had planned to get drunk and listen to some records. She arrived at the dark farmhouse in the pouring rain and knocked on the front door, but did not get a response. Back then, when plans changed, you mostly didn't find out until it was too late. You couldn't send a text message or even call whenever you wanted. Figuring that something had happened, my grandmother decided to spend the night in the empty house anyways, so she didn't have to drive back in the pouring rain. She began to search for a spare key. She went around to the back of the house, the wind tearing at her coat and nearly knocking her over. She reached the back porch and continued to search for the spare key. Apparently, it wasn't in its normal spot, so she sat on the somewhat sheltered back porch behind a pile of firewood. She said that her being too stubborn to go back home was what likely saved her life that night. She lit up a cigarette and sat smoking for an uncertain amount of time. She didn't want to break into her girlfriend's house, but she also didn't want to go back out in the rain and return to her car and drive back in these conditions, which had only gotten worse. She stated that lightning was crisscrossing all around the sky, and the wind was making the wooden fence lean at a sharp angle. She then saw light coming from inside the house. It wasn't the light of a lamp or anything. It was a beam of light that flashed quickly. Figuring that her friend had returned home, she stood and pressed her face to the window. She didn't knock or call out because she figured that the noise from the storm would just drown her out. So she just waited to be spotted by the window. The flashlight disappeared into the other room, and after another moment, she caught the sight of a man she didn't know, moving around way too slowly to be someone who knew the layout of the house. She only caught a quick glimpse of him in the darkness, but she saw enough to know that it wasn't a member of her girlfriend's family. She thought it could have been a neighbor that she didn't know, but his suspicious behavior was making her uneasy. So she ducked down and decided to wait for a while, despite the raging storm. After a while of hiding crouched beneath the window, she would occasionally see the flashlight beam dance across the back porch from one of the inside windows. She figured if it was someone who was supposed to be there, they would have either turned on a light, or at the very least, would have stopped wandering around so slowly, as if they were looking for something. After what she suspects was a few minutes, the door to the back porch opened, and the stranger stepped outside and shined the light across the length of the porch, including the wood pile, which fortunately prevented her from being seen. She stayed hidden, and after another brief sweep with the flashlight, the person went back inside. The stranger could have easily found her had he decided to be more thorough, but she figured he doubted that anyone would be hiding there, given how rough the weather was. She heard the door slam again, and the stranger disappeared back inside the house. She peeked in through the window and watched as the man went upstairs. She waited in apprehension until he came back down to the ground floor, still carefully shining the flashlight around. He eventually wandered over to the front of the house. She then heard the front door slam shut. Afraid that he may walk around the perimeter of the house and find her, she emerged from her hiding place and opened the back door, which was now unlocked. She carefully made her way inside and locked the door behind her. Without turning on any lights, she ran to the front door and locked it as well, before looking out to the front yard. She didn't spot the intruder anywhere. Shivering, she locked herself in the downstairs bathroom and covered herself up with towels. She was very aware that the man could potentially still be in the house or even have his own key. After she dried herself off, she risked a quick run up the stairs and locked herself in her friend's bedroom. She tried the light in the bedroom for a split second just to see if the power was out. It wasn't. She then laid down on the bed, exhausted. She nearly drifted off when a blinding flash came from outside, followed by a thunderous crackling. It jolted her for a moment, but rational thought prevailed. One of the old trees out front must have been struck by lightning. She then fell asleep. The following day, she got up and searched the house in the daylight. There were still no signs of her girlfriend or her family anywhere. She called her mother and then the police. An officer arrived a short while later, and she explained everything that happened the night before. She was still unable to get a hold of her friend. The officer acknowledged that it may have been someone with permission to be in the house, but decided to take a look around anyway. After a while, he called to my grandmother. He asked my grandmother to describe what the stranger from the night before had been wearing, but she couldn't recall with any real certainty, as it had been pretty dark. Apparently, a body was discovered in the tall grass of the front yard. My grandmother's girlfriend returned home after the body had been removed from the property. She had been stranded several towns over the night before because of the road being washed out by the storm. The corpse was a man who had been an older friend of the family, but someone who most definitely did not have permission to be in their house alone. As predicted, what had killed him was a bolt of lightning that struck him down in the front yard. The man was carrying a 6-inch hunting knife in his hand, which had likely been what attracted the strike. It was suspected that the man came looking for my grandmother's friend, as she had rejected his advances in the past. But when he spotted the strange car in the driveway, he decided to enter the house cautiously to find out who was visiting. This is all just a theory, but the family stressed this man would have never been allowed to access the house by himself, and they had nothing of his that he might have been looking for. My grandmother thinks that the timing of him leaving the house and the lightning strike was off. She said it was roughly a half-hour window between her entering the house, locking up, and drying off before hearing the lightning strike. She doesn't think he was still in the process of leaving. She suspects he was on his way back. This happened in 1987 when I was about 15 years old. I used to live in this small town in northern Ohio. Back in those days, I was the neighborhood paperboy for a while, and I would deliver the newspapers almost every morning before school. During the summer, I would often ride my bike around to the park or go hang out with my friends down by the lake. The point is, I was often seen on my bike, a lot. So it was unfortunate that during one of my paper routes, a reckless driver blindsided me, which resulted in my left thigh being fractured and my bicycle being completely destroyed. It took me about 3 months to recover, and by the time I did, the paper had already hired a new delivery boy, and I was left without a bike. And on top of all that, they never caught the guy who ran into me. There's no real nice way to say this, but my parents are neglective assholes, and I stopped talking to them years ago. At the time, my injury was viewed more as an inconvenience in their eyes. The local police department wasn't really much better either. It was pretty much run by a family who had zero interest in enforcing the law and seemed to be more concerned with blackmailing prostitutes in exchange for sexual favors. Nobody really gave a rat's ass that some drunk asshole nearly ended my life. But what could I really do about it? I was only 15, and I just had to make the best of things and carry on. Shortly after I was released from the hospital, my friend Kyle invited me over to his house, claiming that his parents were out of town on business, and he had discovered a bottle of Jack Daniels that his father had forgotten to lock away in his liquor cabinet. I, of course, obliged. Without a bike, I unfortunately had to walk everywhere, and I knew better than to hitchhike in this backward-ass town. By the time I got to Kyle's, it was around 7 p.m., and Kyle was already piss drunk, with about 90% of the bottle already gone. After about 20 minutes of sitting on his couch and listening to him drivel on about how he wanted to smash the math teacher, Kyle vomited on the living room floor and promptly passed out. So, being sober and frustrated, I decided to make the long trek home in the dark. Getting out of Kyle's neighborhood was simple enough, but there was a long, dark stretch of highway that I had to traverse to get back to my place. Making this trip during the day was no big deal, but it could be quite daunting at night. There are no streetlights on this road, so unless the moon was out, it would be nearly pitch black. It was a half moon out that night, so things were a bit obscured, but you could still see enough of your surroundings to make your way. My house was off at the first intersection you came upon. The rest of the way was well lit from there, but it was still a good 3 mile hike to get to the intersection. I was about a quarter way down this road when I got this inexplicable sensation that I was being followed. I turned around to see what appeared to be a dark figure standing in the middle of the road. Barely visible in the moonlight, it appeared to be just standing there, so I figured it was probably one of the many drug addicts that lurked around these parts. I quickened my pace and scolded myself for forgetting my pocket knife, which I usually carried on me for protection. But I didn't want to show that I was afraid, so I didn't walk too fast, but I also didn't take my time. About another 5 minutes pass, and I look behind me again. The dark figure was now on the sidewalk and was now noticeably closer. Again, I want to point out that it was just standing there. It was not apparent to me that the figure was running or walking towards me. It was almost as if every time I would turn around, it would just stop and stare at me. Obviously, this is not the type of experience you want to have when you're walking home alone in the dark. So I wasted no time in making my way towards the intersection. It wasn't until the lights of the intersection came into view that I heard a pounding behind me. Something inside me told me not to turn around, but I couldn't resist. My worst nightmare was confirmed when I saw the dark figure barreling towards me. The distance between us was closing fast, and from where I was, I could tell that there was something in its hands. The way it was holding this object made me conclude that it was a knife. I ran as fast as I could, tearing past the intersection and across the road to the entrance of my neighborhood. From the entrance, you could see the intersection clearly. When I turned back for the last time, I could see a deranged-looking man standing under one of the streetlights with a massive butcher knife in his right hand. He appeared to be about 6 feet tall, with a balding head and a beard that went down to his stomach. He was severely out of shape, but someone who could easily overpower a 15-year-old. As I darted down the neighborhood street, I could hear a crazed voice shouting from behind me.
"If I ever see you again, I'm going to cut your head off."
As soon as I got to my house and slammed the door shut behind me, I nearly passed out from exhaustion and panic. My parents were not home at the time, so I ended up locking myself in my bedroom and eventually passed out after hours of just staring out my bedroom window. I didn't call the cops simply because it did not occur to me in my panicked state of mind. And by the time I could think straight again, I came to the conclusion that the corrupted police force would not take my claim seriously. And you can pretty much apply that same reasoning as to why I did not tell my parents. As soon as I turned 18, I left that shithole behind and have never looked back. In some bizarre way, I now view that deranged man in the darkness as a manifestation of everything wrong with that town. I grew up in the village of Dunning, Nebraska, and I have very fond memories of that place, but simply put, as I started getting older, I soon realized that there was absolutely no future for me in Dunning, and I enlisted in the military when I was 19. Growing up in Dunning during the 1980s is something that I would akin to a setting in a Stephen King novel. You had your religious nut jobs, wisecracking town folk, and an atmosphere of isolation. That's not to say that the town was inherently creepy or anything, it just seemed cut off from the rest of the world. It's definitely not a place for social media influencers to visit, because if you're not into outdoor activities, you're going to be bored as shit there. To the east of the town is the Nebraska National Forest, which our family would often visit when I was a kid. Being such a close-knit community, I was pretty much friends with all the other kids my age. Something that we often enjoyed doing was going fishing in the nearby rivers. I recall that my school was taking a field trip to the National Forest, and I couldn't attend for some reason. I can't seem to remember if it was because of poor grades or bad behavior. Probably a mixture of the two, to be honest. When I got out of school that day, I was pretty much the only kid left in town. So this was one of those rare times where I would go fishing by myself. As soon as I got home that day, I spent about 20 minutes doing my household chores before packing up my fishing gear and setting off on my bike. My friends and I would usually fish in the Middle Loup River because it was very close to the town. However, since they weren't with me on that day, I decided to head down to the Dismal River, which ran along the west side of the town before merging into Middle Loup. Unlike Middle Loup, the Dismal River was sort of on the outskirts of Dunning. To give you a lay of the land, beyond the Dismal River is no man's land in every sense of the word. Aside from some few residential properties, there is absolutely nothing for miles but hills and trees. I spent about 30 minutes casting my line, but I wasn't catching anything, much to my dismay, so I relocated my operation upstream towards where the two rivers intersected. Suddenly, I could feel a dense pressure in the atmosphere. I'm sure most of you can relate to that creepy, unnerving feeling you get when someone is watching you. I did my best to ignore this feeling and continue fishing. But there was something that kept drawing my attention towards one of the dead trees that was situated about 30 feet from the riverbank. The exact year was 1988, when the entire country was experiencing droughts that caused many trees to die off. It wasn't long before I could smell something foul in the air. It was a thick, putrid stench, like something died and had been decomposing in the sun all day. But strangely, I did not see a single vulture in the sky. They would usually be swarming any animal carcasses shortly after they died. Curiosity finally got the best of me, and I set my fishing rod down and went to investigate the dead tree. As I approached, I noticed that there was a hole in the ground, like someone had dug a grave and forgot to throw the dirt back over the hole. As I got closer, I could feel goosebumps up and down my arms. Once I got close enough, I peered down into the hole, and I will swear until my dying day that this is what I saw. There was a body of a young girl lying at the bottom of the hole. I vaguely remember seeing a mangled nightgown that was wrapped around the body. As a 12-year-old, I didn't scare easy, but this sent me fleeing back into town, bawling my eyes out. By the time I got back home, my dad was home from work. I told him between sobs what I had seen. My dad was very good friends with one of the deputies at the Blaine County Sheriff's Office, and he immediately called him and relayed to him what I had seen by the river. Me and my dad met three Blaine County deputies near the spot where I had seen the corpse. They even brought a trained canine along with them, but after hours of combing through the riverbanks, they could not find a single thing. I was later scolded by my father for making up stories, and that I should never waste the police's time. As punishment, I wasn't allowed to go fishing for months after this incident, which really sucked, because there wasn't much else to do in Dunning. Even after all these years, I still stand by my story. It may have been something of a supernatural nature, but I did see the body of a young girl lying at the bottom of that hole. I didn't have a wild imagination as a kid, and I may have misbehaved every once in a while, but I would never make up a story about seeing something that awful. The smell, the position of the body, the dirty nightgown. I remember too many details for this to be some kind of delusion. There is another possibility that only occurred to me as an adult. If what I experienced wasn't a supernatural phenomenon, could the sheriff's office have covered up something? The hills of Nebraska have their secrets. This happened a few months ago. I'm a 23-year-old female, and I had finally bought a car for myself. I loved driving around and listening to music. I usually liked doing this by myself. On this night, it was around 7 p.m., and it was winter time. On this particular drive, I took two of my siblings. My sister was 18, and my brother was 13. I took them along with me after their constant pleading because they were bored. Now, I'm a smoker, and coming from a South Asian household, women are not supposed to smoke. So I took these opportunities to smoke without worrying that my parents would catch me. The city that I live in has some bad areas. However, we lived in a quiet suburban area. So I didn't give a second thought about parking somewhere, getting out of my car, and lighting up a cigarette. I don't like smoking in my car. So there I was, parked beneath a street light, scrolling away on my phone. It was getting pretty dark, but I wasn't too worried about it, as I would visit this road frequently, and it wasn't too far from my aunt's house. As I was smoking my cigarette, I look up from my phone, and I see a man emerging from some bushes nearby. I didn't think much of it. I see people walking around here all the time. This man was very tall, standing at least 6'4". He was on the opposite sidewalk. I assumed that he was just going to carry on walking, so I looked back to my phone. Until I looked up again and saw him standing in front of my car, staring at me. My sister, who was still in the car, must have been watching him as well, because she knocked on the window, telling me to come in. I had already put out my cigarette and was making my way to the driver's side door, keys in hand. The man was still standing there, not moving a muscle. I got in and locked my door and breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that maybe I was just overreacting. As I put my keys in the ignition, I looked up to see where the guy was, but he was no longer standing in front of my car. I looked in my rearview mirror and saw that he was now standing behind us. He was taking pictures of my license plate. I slightly rolled down my window, and I could see his face a bit clearer now. He appeared to be an Indian man with a beard and a hoodie over his head, obscuring some of the features on his face. I asked him as politely as I could, "Excuse me, what are you doing?" The man comes towards my window, but still kept his distance. He then said in a very aggressive tone, "Do you know who I am?" I didn't know if he was asking a rhetorical question or not. "I have a lot of shit going on in my house. I don't need you parking here and watching me. You look real suspicious. Just randomly parking here with your two friends? What do you think you're doing? Get the fuck out of here." I chuckled nervously. I was trying to keep calm, but my anxiety was already halfway through the roof at this point. I didn't understand how I looked threatening in any way, as I'm a small girl who's been told that she looks like a kid. I was in my pajamas, and I was clearly minding my own business. "Look, I just parked here to smoke. I come here all the time since I live close by." That's when the man got right up to my window. He slid his fingers through the gap and forced my window all the way down, screaming at the top of his lungs, "Get the hell out of here!" I screamed in terror and told him to stop swearing, as I had a minor in the back seat and he was scaring him. He then screamed, "If you don't get out of here right now, I'll damage your fucking car!" My adrenaline was running at full speed, and I was terrified. I didn't even bother putting my seatbelt on. I bolted out of there, and in my panic, I went straight ahead at a junction. It led me to a dead end. As soon as I stopped my car, I took the opportunity to try and calm down. My whole body was shaking. I couldn't even keep my foot on the clutch. My sister was quick to ask me if I was okay. But before I could even answer, I saw a pair of headlights coming right for us. It was the man. He was going at least 50 on a 20, and he almost crashed right into my car. But by some miracle, he just missed us. After his car screeched to a stop, he jumped out, and that's when I realized that my window was still all the way down. I quickly tried to roll my window back up, but the man was too quick. He then dove into my car. Half of his body was through my window, I screamed so loudly with his ear right next to my face that I'm sure I deafened him. He was trying to force my car keys from the ignition, but I thanked my lucky stars that with my car, to release the key, you had to have your foot on the clutch, which I didn't. With one hand, I was pressing down on the horn of my car to make as much noise as possible so I could alert anyone who was nearby. I scratched his hands away from my car keys, and I heard my poor siblings crying their eyes out. My little brother had no idea what he could do to protect me, and my sister was in the passenger seat, experiencing all of this firsthand. I finally managed to force the man out of my car, and that's when he started screaming again.
"I thought I told you to get out of here. Now I'm going to fucking kill you, bitch!"
The deranged man then attempted to pull my door handle, trying to get inside, and that's when I floored it the fuck out of there. I didn't care that my body was shaking like a fish out of water. My main priority was the safety of my siblings. I knew that we were making a loud commotion. I laid down on my horn, trying to get the attention of anyone nearby, but nobody came to help us. I managed to maneuver my way out of the dead end, and then went down a new street, into a totally different area, and I then parked. I knew that this was probably not a good idea, but I didn't see the guy following us. The three of us just sat in my car, sobbing away. This was the first time that anything like this has ever happened to us. I called the police, and I immediately wanted to punch myself in the face when the dispatcher asked if I had gotten the man's registration number. Of course, in my panic, I didn't. I wanted to slap myself in the face, because I listened to a lot of horror stories on YouTube, and I always felt that they taught me how to handle certain situations. The dispatcher was very understanding, as was the female officer who called me the next day. As a woman, she understood how scary it must have been for me, and I cried to her as I recounted the incident. Unfortunately, the cops informed me that there was no CCTV cameras in that area, so there wasn't really much that they could do, especially with me not knowing where he came from. If he did in fact come from one of the nearby houses, I didn't know which one. The officer apologized to me, but it was really my fault for not mentally noting important information. They made a report of my attack, so if a similar incident happens in that area, they can make the connection. The officer said that when I parked my car, the man was likely doing something illegal nearby, and that's why he freaked out on me. I personally think it was just some deranged individual who enjoyed scaring people who looked like easy prey. Growing up in a working-class Latino family, we didn't have the luxury of taking lavish vacations throughout the year. However, that didn't stop us from exploring the natural wonders of Southern California through camping. At a young age, my sister and I understood the value of camping through our shared respect for Mother Nature. Over time, we mastered surviving in the outdoors, so much so that we desired to explore new campgrounds throughout the state. On one such occasion, a coworker of my father overheard him talking about his summer vacation plans and suggested to him a new campground to check out. To this day, my parents nor I are unable to remember the name of the campsite, yet we all agree that it was somewhere in the hills of San Diego County. My father was excited for the prospect of visiting a new national park and packed up the car for the customary family summer retreat. The drive up to the campsite was long and dangerous. Even though we were driving during the day, the steepness of the mountain, coupled with the numerous blind turns, had everyone sitting on the edge of their seats. Arguments soon erupted amongst us, as we didn't find any signs indicating where to go. This was in the age before smartphones and GPS. Eventually, we convinced our father to stop and ask for directions. As the campground came into view, we all let out a collective sigh of relief. We made it. And yet, the place did not look like it was a national park at all. There wasn't a ranger station or a welcome center anywhere in sight. The lake appeared murky like a bog, whereas the campground itself was devoid of life. A proverbial ghost town, with the only inhabitants being us. With our bewilderment aside, we cautiously surveyed the area, finding any clues that will guide us to the keeper of this place. Out in the distance, we saw a crumbling, open sign dangling in the window of a dilapidated diner. Just as the sign implied, we entered the establishment to inquire about the place. Pushing the creaking door open, we were greeted by the owner of the diner, a gaunt-looking man who I would now say was plucked straight out of the movie The Hills Have Eyes.
"Well, how can I help y'all folks on this fine day?"
My dad replied. "We made reservations to camp here, but I'm not sure if this is the right place." We then handed the man our booking papers for him to inspect. With his bony fingers grasping the pages, he replied,
Yeah, you have the right place. I'm the groundskeeper of this here national park. Let me finish some paperwork on my end, and I'll get things ready for you and your family to stay here with us."
As he wobbled off to the back of the diner, my sister and I retreated to the safety of our car. Although we were children at the time, we both felt a sense of unease, even dread, at the thought of spending the night here. Despite our worries, our parents reassured us that the vacation had only just begun, albeit with a few bumps along the way. As we neared the site, all of our concerns were tossed out the window, as it was time to transform this empty lot into our secure encampment. The rest of the day came and went, as our campsite was beginning to take shape. The sounds of our radio, along with the rhythmic banging of the hammer, were the only echoes greeting us as the sun began to set. This detail stood out to me, due to the fact it was early July here in Southern California, and there are always people camping around this time. In either case, we all just brushed it aside and thought that more people would arrive by tomorrow. And they did. On the following day of the trip, my father went fishing at the lake. While he was off on his own adventure, my sister and I decided that it was time to have one of our own. Recruiting the aid of our mother, we set out to explore the campgrounds. To our surprise and elation, we discovered that this campground had its own public swimming pool. With our minds made up, the three of us got into our bathing suits, slathered on the sunscreen, and made our way to the pool. Soon my sister and I were splashing around in the water without a care in the world, until I noticed three suspicious men dressed entirely in black. They came and sat at one of the chairs at the opposite end of the pool from where our mother was watching us. At first, I thought the men were new campers that had recently arrived at the grounds to examine the swimming pool, but to my dismay, the men just huddled around each other and whispered incomprehensible things while staring intently at the two of us. My mother's instincts caught on to the predatory behavior, and she decided to cut our excursion to the swimming pool short. When my father arrived from the lake, he said he was unable to catch any fish, and that the fish he did find were all belly up dead in the water. My mother then informed my father of the three suspicious-looking men eyeing my sister and I at the pool. This infuriated him. My father, brandishing his machete, stormed out in search of the group of men, ostensibly to talk some sense into them. Some time passed, and my father arrived back at the campsite, dismayed that he did not find the men, only a mother and her two little boys. This point may sound insignificant at first, but it will become important later in the story. As night fell, my sister and I were preparing to go to sleep, when we were suddenly jolted awake by the pleading screams of a woman. Her pleas were joined by the cries of two young children and various male voices demanding their silence. My father recognized the woman's voice as the mother he saw earlier in the day camping alone with her two kids. My father, who is a former Marine, loaded his rifle and concealed his hunting knife. He then proceeded to tell my mother to take care of us while handing her a loaded gun. I then saw my father head out towards the campsite where the single mother and her children were staying. My sister and I were petrified when we noticed the terror-stricken look on our mother's face. As the yelling escalated, two thunderous bangs from the rifle rang out. which put an end to the chaos. Seconds later, we heard the crackling branches closing in, as someone moved quickly towards us. My mother, with eyes wide and knuckles clenched, aimed into the darkness, ready to protect us at all costs. To our relief, my father emerged from the shadows with a fearful mother and her two sobbing children. My father then claimed that he scared off the men who were harassing us at the pool and will be helping the mother pack her things to leave. To ensure that they made their way down the mountain safely, my father offered to follow her in our car until she got to the main highway. In a moment of reprieve, the woman held her children tight. We all assured her that their safety was of the utmost importance, and knowing my father, any form of aggression needs to be handled quickly. With pleasantries aside, my father departed yet again to help the mother pack up her campsite and leave this backwater excuse for a national park. The few rays of sunlight that streamed into our tent signaled the start of a new day, since our father had left to escort the small family from the imminent danger. With a look of apprehension on my mother's face, my sister and I started to pack up camp, knowing all too well that we did not want to risk our lives spending another night at this place. I was making my way to the bathrooms when my eye caught the glimpse of our car slowly making its way back to camp. I ran back to tell my mother and sister, who noticed the car as well, and soon the bloodshot eyes of my father behind the wheel came into view. As he exited the car, he informed us that the mother and her children made it safely to the highway. This was then followed by a long pause, with my father saying, "Now let's get the hell out of here ourselves." With that, we all took our positions and packed up the rest of our camping gear. Before leaving this godforsaken place, my father informed the owner of the diner about what happened last night and about the three suspicious-looking men. The only thing that the emaciated-looking man said was, "Well, it's a damn shame that you and your family can't stay here a little longer." We then hightailed it out of there like bats out of hell, vowing never to return. Ever since this harrowing experience, my family and I have been unable to get my sister to go camping again. As time went on, I decided to ask my father where he had heard about that awful place, to which he added a new detail not previously disclosed. He mentioned that upon returning to work, he wanted to confront his coworker about the horrible camping recommendation he gave. When he tried to locate him, another coworker stated that the same man quit a couple of days before my father was going to return from vacation. My father was left speechless and confused upon hearing this. Was the man somehow connected to those three men? If so, what were their motives for harassing a family out in the middle of nowhere? The answers to these questions we will never know, but what I do know is this. If my father did not intervene on that fateful night, that single mother and her kids would have met a fate far worse than a failed camping trip. I am an immigrant from Belarus. English is not my first language, so I apologize if I phrase things differently. Here's some backstory. I was only 11 when my family left the country after the collapse of the Soviet Union. My father was involved with the Communist Party and would frequently visit Moscow when I was a boy. I don't know all the details. I don't even know what exactly my father's role was in the USSR. But from what I understand, we were granted asylum in the United States and had to flee Belarus in 1991. But that's not really why I'm writing this story. This is about something I saw in my childhood that has scarred me for life. This took place roughly a year before we left, so I'm guessing the year was 1990. My family, like many others, lived in a massive apartment building in Minsk. There were two other identical apartment buildings adjacent to ours, and directly behind the buildings was a playground area where I would play with my friends Sasha and Victor. Beyond the playground was a section of trees that separated a shopping plaza from the apartment grounds. I remember that my mother was feeling ill and was bedridden, and my father was away on business in Moscow, so I was pretty much on my own that night. I remember that I had gotten bored watching TV in the living room and decided to go outside and see if any of my friends were at the playground. I would say this was around 8 p.m., and it was dark out. By then, most of the children were inside, and I don't even think anyone was allowed on the playground at that time, but I didn't care. There was no one around to tell me to go back inside, and I was pretty excited to have the playground all to myself. It was chilly out that night, but it was not snowing, so I figured that I would play on the slides and swing set until I either got bored or if security came along and told me to go back inside. So there I was, just swinging in the dark, when I heard something near the fence that separated the trees from the playground. It was a strange noise, like someone was sawing wood, but there was something just off about it. I ignored the sound, but it became louder as time passed, to the point where I became curious as to what was causing this strange noise. There were no lights at the playground itself, but there were lights mounted to the back of the apartment buildings that illuminated things just enough to where you could see your surroundings. But the trees beyond the fence were pitch black. I got off the swing set and approached the edge of the playground. The sound continued getting louder, even as I got up right to the fence. It wasn't until I let out a curious, "Hello?" that the noise ceased. I stood there staring into the dark trees, waiting for a response, but all remained silent. After about another minute passed, I innocently asked, "Why are you chopping down trees in the dark?" I then heard a shuffling from within the trees, and soon, I saw a dark figure come into view, but did not step out from the tree line. What happened next is something that still makes me want to vomit out my insides. The dark figure then threw something. The object flew over the fence and hit me directly in the chest. I was knocked backwards, more out of surprise than the actual force of the impact.
"Hey, why'd you do that?"
I shouted. But before I could get another word out, I caught a glimpse of what had been thrown at me. A severed human arm was lying on the ground in front of me. I screamed at the top of my lungs and ran back towards the apartments, bawling my eyes out. I stormed into our apartment and sat on the living room couch to collect myself. I did think about waking my sick mother and telling her about what happened, but decided against it. To give you some perspective, my mother grew up in Siberia, and she could be quite ruthless at times. Not only would she not be too happy about being woken up, but she most likely wouldn't believe my story. And I probably wouldn't be able to sit down for a week if she found out I left the apartment alone after dark. So I kept this incident to myself. As a child, I understood that what happened was scary, but I had no grasp of the implications. I thought there was a monster in the woods who ate people who came out after dark. Now that I'm an adult, there are some things that I've come to realize. For our remaining time in Belarus, I never saw or heard any kind of investigation regarding a missing person or a mutilated body being discovered, which is nothing out of the ordinary living in Soviet society. The monster in the woods, hiding in the trees that night, was most likely a sadistic madman dismembering a human body with a hacksaw. There is one more thing that I should mention. For the rest of the time that we lived there, I cannot for the life of me recall ever seeing my friend Sasha again after that night. My name is Bree. This happened in 2016. I was 19 years old at the time. I was up late the night before into the early morning studying, and I hadn't had much sleep, so I had just woken up from a nap. I decided to hop in the shower to wake myself. That's when I heard this weird scraping sound coming from somewhere outside. I stopped the shower and peered out from behind the curtain, and then made my way over to the window. I saw nothing, but I could still hear the noise. I thought it may have been my neighbor working in a shed, so I ignored the disturbance and finished up in the shower. Before I continue, I should inform you that I have severe anxiety problems, and I often get a little paranoid sometimes. It also doesn't help that I have PTSD as well. Anyways, I was now back in my room, and I took a seat on my bed. I texted my then-boyfriend and asked him what he wanted for dinner. While I was waiting for him to respond, I just relaxed and scrolled through my Facebook. I was reading an article about the recent clown sightings that were happening at the time, when I was interrupted by the sound of footsteps coming from outside. I stopped and listened carefully. I heard a few more steps, followed by a tapping noise. I was a bit confused by this. It hadn't yet occurred to me that I had an unwelcome guest outside. I was thinking why my boyfriend hadn't knocked on the door or called before he showed up. We usually had a routine with things like this, especially if I was home alone. He would either text, call, or FaceTime me to let me know when he was on his way home, or if he was at the door, because there had been a lot of shady activity around our neighborhood at the time. I then called out to him, and suddenly, all fell silent. I texted him and asked if he was at the door. There was no reply, so I decided to peek through the bedroom window. While I was making my way to the other side of the room, my phone started ringing. It was my boyfriend wanting to FaceTime. When I answered, he said he was about 15 minutes away. As I was talking to him, I pulled back the curtains of my bedroom window, and that's when all the blood in my veins turned to ice as I came face to face with a fucking clown. I know I wasn't hallucinating. An actual clown was looking at me through the window, smiling. After my initial shock, I actually started to laugh, thinking that this had to be some kind of prank my boyfriend was pulling on me. So I played along, pretending to be terrified, and whispered into the phone. "Very funny, asshole. Love the whole scary clown thing." I chuckled and rolled my eyes. My boyfriend was confused, and I explained to him about the clown at the window, and said that he and his friend did a good job scaring the piss out of me. He seemed confused, saying that all of his friends were hanging out at the pub, and that he was not a part of any plan to prank me. Upon hearing this, I felt my stomach in my throat as I looked back at the clown, who was still just outside my window. He reached into his costume and pulled out a very real-looking butcher's knife. By this point, I wasn't sure what was going on, so I grabbed my baseball bat. My boyfriend told me that he was now only a few minutes away. He shouted at me to stay inside and to lock all the doors and windows. I quickly closed the curtains and went into the lounge. It wasn't long before I heard a loud pounding on the front door. Suddenly, I heard a creepy voice coming from the other side.
"Let me in, child."
I didn't respond to the voice. I just stood perfectly still, waiting for the next move. Loud pounding rang out again, causing the door to rattle on its hinges, but I kept quiet, even when I heard the doorknob rattling. Although I was pretty scared at this point, I was also getting a tad irritated and yelled out to the clown,
"Fuck off! Go annoy someone else!"
I then heard muffled laughter, followed by the creepy voice.
"Please let me in, doll. I just want to play. I want to play with your insides."
I had enough of this. I was about to go out and confront this creepy asshole myself when I heard my boyfriend's voice, who was still on the phone, say,
"Hang up and call the cops."
After some consideration, I thought that maybe confronting the creepy clown outside with a butcher's knife was not the correct course of action. So I did as my boyfriend said. I left the lounge and was soon explaining to the police dispatcher the situation. I was on my way back to my room when I heard the sound of glass breaking. I stopped in my tracks and told them that I think the clown just broke into the house. They immediately told me to get somewhere safe, and that's when I heard my ex yelling out,
"Hey, what the fuck are you doing? Get the hell out of here! The police are on the way!"
The clown just bellowed out a psychotic laugh and took off. As I made my way back into the bedroom, something caught my eye. I peered out the window. Through a gap in the curtains, I saw another clown. He appeared to be holding some kind of saw blade in his hand. I went to move, but I was like a deer caught in the headlights. I couldn't move or scream. Fear then overcame me, as I realized my boyfriend was now out there with two creepy clowns. I screamed into the phone.
There's another clown outside my bedroom. Please hurry.
After a few moments, I was relieved when I heard my boyfriend at the back door. I quickly let him inside. We then held each other tightly until the police arrived. After taking our statements, the police discovered a rusted hacksaw and an axe lying on the ground outside of my bedroom window. There were red marks all over them. Of course, the creepy clowns that had turned my night into a freak show were nowhere to be found. After that night, I struggled to fall asleep. I often think to myself, what would have happened to me if I had been stupid enough to open that door? Were they just a couple of thrill seekers looking to frighten a girl who was all alone? Or were they, in fact, out for blood? I was born, raised, and still live in Texas. I come from a family of hunters. It's pretty much a family tradition. I'm going to tell you about something that I experienced when I was 20 years old, back in 2005. My father had just been diagnosed with lung cancer, and everyone in my family was naturally devastated by this, especially me, since my dad and I were very close. I had a lot of other personal stuff going on in my life at the time, and I felt that I needed to go out for a few days just to clear my head. I decided to make it a solo hunting trip, and packed up some camping gear, along with my Marlin 336 that my dad gifted to me when I was 18. If I could get sentimental for a moment, my father ended up passing away 3 years after his diagnosis, and to this day, I still use that rifle for hunting. Anyways, I'd say this happened around late October, early November. I don't want to be too specific with a location, because technically, I wasn't supposed to be hunting in this specific area. However, I will disclose that it was near the Mexican border. This will be important later. I decided to set up camp for 3 days before heading back. I had been hunting on this land before with some friends of mine, and I knew the precautions to take not to be spotted by the game warden. I'm sure if there's any other hunters listening to this broadcast, they'll be more than happy to tell you that we often wipe our asses with the rule book. Before anyone judges me too harshly, or the practice of hunting in general, I will say that I'm a very spiritual person, and I have a profound respect for Mother Nature. I don't leave trash everywhere, and every animal that I put down, I never let go to waste. I'll be the first to admit, there are hunters that give us a bad name, and me not following the rules is more of a middle finger to the government than it is to the sport of hunting. I once straight up beat the shit out of someone who was a friend of a friend for shooting a stray dog for absolutely no reason. If it's consolation to anyone, I handed him a horrible ass-whooping for that. But I digress. The first day went off without a hitch. No problems whatsoever, aside from the fact that there was no game to be found anywhere. So I figured that I would head further south the next day to see if my luck would improve. Other hunters knew about this restricted location and may have already cleaned out this area. As night fell, I found myself sprawled out next to my truck, just staring up at the night sky, wondering if me and my dad would ever take another hunting trip together. That's when I heard the sound of footsteps slowly making their way through a nearby brush. This was alarming for obvious reasons. Whoever they had the drop on me. I knew better than to light up a campfire under these circumstances. But if this person was roaming around in the dark without a flashlight, they may have had some kind of night vision apparatus, giving them the advantage. I was concerned, because if you were looking at me through the trees at that particular moment, it would have appeared that I was sleeping. I was in this odd position where I was resting on top of my sleeping bag with a blanket, because I felt claustrophobic being fully immersed in a sleeping bag. It was a good thing, too. because this meant I was able to mobilize quickly, and something told me that I only had seconds to make a decision. I rolled sideways, and as soon as I did, I caught a quick glimpse of a muzzle flash coming from the tree line directly in front of me. I felt dirt fly up and hit my back, from the bullet striking the ground next to me. I scrambled to my feet as more shots rang out from the trees, one of them shattering the passenger side window of my truck. I took cover behind the bed of my pickup and quickly drew the .38 snubnose that I had strapped to my ankle. After the gunfire died down, I laid flat on the ground and returned fire in the direction of the trees from under the truck. I heard several sets of footsteps fleeing from the area, but I held my position in case my theory about the night vision was correct. With only two rounds left in my .38, I pretty much spent the rest of that night underneath my truck with my pistol aimed at the darkness until the sun came out and illuminated my surroundings. I very cautiously got out from beneath my vehicle and packed up my gear as quickly as I could and hightailed it out of there. Later on, when I told a friend of mine about the incident, he said he wished I would have told him that I was heading that way. He would have warned me that the Mexican cartel started using that area to smuggle contraband and people across the nearby border. This friend of mine was a Mexican immigrant himself, and had several family members mixed up in the cartel and coyote groups, so needless to say, I trusted his word. All things considered, I think I got off pretty easy. Had I been in my sleeping bag that night, I have no doubt that bullet would have nailed me. These days, I stick to the designated hunting grounds. Some things are just not worth the risk. I'm from Afghanistan. My family relocated to France in 2003, shortly after the American invasion. I was only 12 years old when it all started. Between 2001 and 2003, armed terrorists would intrude into our home and use it as a headquarters to plot attacks against the invading army. My father suffered from a genetic disease that would eventually take the use of his arms and legs. This is why I think the Taliban chose to hold up in our home. There would be no resistance. The first time they burst through our doors, it was horrifying for me and my two younger sisters. But eventually we got used to waking up and seeing armed men in our living room. About a year after the war broke out, following the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York, the Taliban would begin to raid small villages like mine, looking for recruits to replace the fighters that were killed in combat. Of course, since they knew where I lived, and that my father was in no position to do anything about it, I was one of the first to be taken from my village. Myself and several other boys were blindfolded and loaded onto a truck, then driven to a remote location outside of town. My village was located west of the Hindu Kush Mountains. That's about the only location that I could give for this place. After about an hour of just sitting in the truck, we were finally ordered out, and the blindfolds were removed. By this time it was dark out. The armed men made us line up single file in front of this enormous cave entrance. I remember seeing crates of weapons and ammo at the mouth of this cave. But beyond that, there was nothing but darkness. There were five armed men total. They all had their faces covered, and just stood there with their weapons ready. If I had to guess, they were waiting for their leader to come out and give us the initiation speech. Looking around, I was definitely the oldest of the seven boys that were there. Because of my past experiences with the Taliban, I knew that these men were not the good guys. They may have prayed to the same God as me, but they were ruthless and brutal to their countrymen. I was at the very end of the line. Directly behind me was the cave entrance. So I made a split-second decision and made a break for it. I ran full speed into the dark cave, hearing angry shouting from behind me. I ran past the supply crates and further into the cave. The passage narrowed as I moved forward. I heard the truck reposition. The headlights were now aimed directly at the cave's entrance. I eventually entered an open cavern area. I could hear the men behind me, so using what little light I had, I hid behind a rock formation that was beside the opening and waited for my pursuers. Two of the armed men eventually entered the cavern. I heard one of them saying that if they found me, they would just put a bullet in my head for causing trouble. I peeked my head out from behind my hiding spot to see an AK-47 pointed directly at my face. One of the men had found me. He shouted at me to stand up, and as soon as I did, we both heard a loud scream coming from the other side of the cavern. I only caught a quick glimpse of what was happening. The other man was on the ground, thrashing violently. He was completely covered, head to toe, by enormous spiders. Without exaggeration, these spiders had to be the size of house cats, and there were hundreds of them, crawling all over him. The man who discovered me quickly turned around and gasped at the horrifying sight. I took this opportunity to flee. There was no way I was going further into that cavern. So I used the headlights that were still pointed at the cave's entrance to make my way back out. As I ran, I heard the sounds of gunfire, shortly followed by more screaming. As I neared the cave's opening, the headlights quickly vanished, leaving me in complete darkness. This was the absolute worst time to be in the dark. I made my frantic exit from the cave, just in time to see the taillights of the truck as it sped off. The other boys and the remaining Taliban fighters were gone. They may have thought that what was happening in the cave was an attack by the Americans, and decided to cut and run. I was now scared out of my wits, and I had no idea where I was, and even worse, I was now terrified that these humongous spiders would emerge from the cave and devour me. There was one path through a rock formation that the truck had driven through, and that was the only way I could take. I remember thinking that these spiders could jump on top of me at any moment, so I ran as fast as I could. As soon as I cleared the rocks, I could see the lights of my village in the distance. It took me about 2 hours to reach the town, but I thankfully made it back in one piece. In the time that I was gone, American troops had taken over my village. I was stopped by soldiers and was taken to an interpreter for questioning. I was more than happy to tell them where the Taliban was hiding, and after a while, they eventually dropped me off at my house. My mother was overjoyed to see that I was still alive. When I think back to this experience, I can still say with 100% certainty, what scared me the most was not the armed men who broke into my home and took me from my family. It was what dwelled in that cave. I grew up in the Midwestern United States during the 90s. My family lived in a tight-knit community, and we would often have get-togethers and barbecues with our neighbors. It was truly the American dream. My brothers and I were all very good friends with the kids from our neighborhood, and whenever we would have one of these gatherings, all the kids would get together for a game of manhunt. To avoid any of the back and forth of who would be chosen as the hiders and the seekers, my brothers and I would usually volunteer to be the seekers. There was this giant forest area outside of our neighborhood where the games would take place. And since we would often go fishing with my dad around this area, we knew it pretty well. You could say that we were all very competitive. I remember it was the 4th of July, 1996. The entire community threw a party at the neighborhood park. This meant that we kids were going to have our traditional game of manhunt, one of the biggest we've ever had, and it would take place after the fireworks show. By the time the fireworks stopped, I would say it was around 9:30 p.m. Shortly after, we gathered everyone for the game and began around 9:45. Things started out like any other game. We caught most of the low-level hiders within the first 10 minutes. However, there were still some of the older kids hiding out in the more obscured areas of the park. We were always told never to go too deep into the woods. To give you some perspective, the park we were at was at the very back of our neighborhood. Beyond that was the forest that went on for about 3 miles before you got to the highway that led into town. There was no hunting allowed in this forest, because of its proximity to residential areas, so we would often see a lot of deers and other animals roaming about. Anyways, the game went on for a while longer, and despite their best efforts, we apprehended most of the hiders, except for a girl who was about 8 years old. We'll call her Ashley. I found this to be very odd because Ashley wasn't the best hider, and was usually one of the first to be caught. We made our way to the small lake behind the clubhouse. This was the last area we would check before letting someone know that we couldn't find Ashley. It was about this time that I began to feel this sinking feeling in my stomach. I was only 11 years old at the time, but I could tell that there was something wrong. I distinctly remember seeing the moon reflecting brightly upon the surface of the water as we made our way around the lake. When we got to the far side of the lake, we started hearing a strange noise coming from within the trees. It sounded like someone was being brutally stabbed over and over again. But no screams were accompanying the awful sound. The three of us approached the tree line. When my brother pointed his flashlight into the trees, we saw a hooded figure with its back turned to us. They appeared to be kneeling down and stabbing at something with a large hunting knife. As soon as the beam fell upon the figure, it immediately stopped what it was doing and stood up. The next thing I remember is my oldest brother covering my eyes with his free hand and telling us to run back to the park. The three of us took off and ran back towards the party. I remember hearing the sounds of thudding boots tearing through the brush behind us. As soon as we got back to the party, my older brother told my dad about the man in the woods. The rest of the night is a blur to me. I only remember seeing the police showing up and me falling asleep in my dad's arms. The next morning, I was told that Ashley ended up leaving with her parents while the game was still going on, which explains why we couldn't find her. I didn't get a good look at what the man was stabbing at, but my brother told me it was a deer carcass. I suppose we could just chalk this up to someone hunting in a restricted area. But there's still something that bothers me. What kind of person rapidly stabs at a dead deer in the dark? And even though he was nowhere to be seen by the time we got back to the party, I'm certain that he was chasing us, at least for a short while. It makes me wonder what he would have done if he caught us. That was the very last game of manhunt our neighborhood ever played.